You are listening to a message from City Church, located in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. For more information on City Church, or for additional resources, including service times, recommended readings, and additional audio, please visit citychurchpa.org.
These are words of a song. I just want you to listen to them this morning. The song is called If. If in one unfortunate moment you took everything that I own, everything you've given me from heaven above and everything I've ever known, if you stripped away my ministry, my influence, my reputation, my health, my happiness, my friends, my pride, and my expectation. If you caused for me to suffer or to suffer for the cause of the cross, if the cost of my allegiance is prison and all my freedoms are lost, if you take the breath from my lungs and make an end of my life, if you take the most precious part of me and take my kids and my wife, it would crush me, it would break me. It would suffocate and cause heartache. I would taste a bitter, dark providence, but you would still preserve my faith. What's concealed in the heart of having is revealed in the losing of things. I can't even begin to imagine the sting that kind of pain brings. I would never blame you for evil. Even if you caused me pain, I came into this world with nothing, and when I die, it'll be the same. I will praise your name in the giving and taking away. If I have you, I could lose everything and still consider it gain. Those are tough words to hear, but yet those are words of faith, really modeled after the book of Job. But as we look at the book of Ruth, we get to find out that Naomi is a female Job who's had everything taken away from her. And really everything is driving her to this point. Will you still trust me after everything is lost? Will you still see me as king if everything is lost? And my friends, this morning, this is what the Bible really, really drives us to. It drives us to ask ourselves, if everything was lost and everything was swept from underneath us, would God still be king over your life? If everything was taken from you, would God still be king over your life? And so I love Scripture because Scripture is not only just it's not only just history, it's His story. It's God's dealing with people like us. People like us. If God was, is God still the constant in your story when you're losing things and gaining things and whatever season in life you are in? Is He still the constant in your life? And so we get to see this. We get to see this, and especially I love books like Ruth, and I love books like Esther, because God is hardly mentioned as doing something in those books, but this is actually where God is actually active the most. In those books, when it looks like there's nothing going on, He silently is permeating every sin, moving events, judging deeds, and proving Himself faithful to His covenant even during those times. And let me tell you this, this is where our faith grows the most. When we feel like He is silent, but yet the truth of God's word says He is working. This is when He's working the most. And so I love reading narratives because this is where we get to see the redemptive story. Was God working even during this time? God was working wonders in Naomi's life when she's sitting at ground zero. Her sons have been taken out. Her husband has been taken out. She's sitting at like what looks like ground zero of her life, but she doesn't know she's going to be a great-grandmother to the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. And at that time, it looks like everything is falling apart. And God is still hiding his smile and saying, wait till you find out what's coming out of this. The redemption of all peoples is going to come from this. Right? Right? We get to see this and we get to get exposed to individuals living their lives for the glory of God. We get to see this. And so this is actually what I want you to see this morning as we go through hard times in life. In fact, hard times are never going to leave us as long as we're on this side of eternity. Hard times are never going to leave us, but we need to actually now look at what these hard times try to do and what God intends to do with those hard times. The first thing that we get to see here in this book is the fact that the hard times, suffering, it usually attempts to change our identity. It attempts to change our identity. Look at verse 19. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And if you remember, Bethlehem is the house of bread. They're coming from emptiness. They're coming to fullness now. The house of bread is now, the rumors have now been spreading. The house of bread is now what? Is now being filled. They came to Bethlehem. The whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? And she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. And so we get to see them as they walk. And in those cities, the cities long ago, they used to have one gate. One gate. And so people would know when you're walking in. And as they saw her face. They saw her demeanor. They saw that hard times had come to her. But not only that, they had probably heard about what had happened to her. And then so they ask, is this Naomi? And as they are asking, it says that the whole town was stirred. Right? The whole town was stirred. And as they came into the gate and into this gate, and it just, and you get to see this word here, you get to see that it paints a picture of a joyous shouting and a happiness. They were so happy to see her. They were happy to see her. Is this Naomi? Is this Naomi? They're happy to see her. And there's a way by which when you're reading this, it's almost as if like they're judging her. Right? This is where the narrator is telling a story. He's asking a question, is this Naomi? And if you're looking at it, you would think maybe they're judging her, but they're actually so happy to see her. The word that says that they stirred up that city, that the city was stirred, is the same word that is used at the coronation of Solomon in 1 Kings 1:45. It says that the city resounded in joyous excitement. So it's not a word of judging. They were so excited to see her as she walks in, and they're so happy to see her. But not only that, that this same word is used when the Ark of the Covenant is being brought in 1 Samuel 4:5, when the Ark of the Covenant, which is a symbol of the presence of God, is being brought back to Jerusalem, and people, it says that they echoed with joyous shouts. This is the same word that is used. They were so happy to see her. And so the people had known Naomi. And then they're now celebrating their long lost friend. And this is now what's so beautiful about this is the fact that this is a question for us. In fact, this is a question for us as people. When broken people walk back into, we have a sign out there that says, welcome home. When they're coming back home, we know, just like St. Augustine said, he said, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Jesus would say also in Matthew 11, he'd say, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And is this the kind of demeanor that we have when we see broken people walking back into God's house? That's a question that we need to be asking ourselves. First of all, here, they are walking back into the house of bread, Bethlehem. And we know Jesus said, I am the what? I am the bread of life. They're walking back into the house of bread. Do we receive them with demeanor or do we identify them with their pain? Do we receive them or do we look at them? And this is what the society does. We've started identifying people, oh, he is a drug addict, he is this, he is that, he is that. Do we identify them as God's people, as who God called them? Her name is Naomi. It means pleasant. Do we still see their identity as static, as staying the same, even when they're rock bottom? So they receive her back. Or do we start analyzing them, start looking at maybe what their fault is? Shouldn't have left Bethlehem in the first place. I mean, your husband is called Elimelech, God is king, should have read the memo. Right? What were you guys doing? It's your fault. This is not the demeanor that you get to see here. They receive her. And it's just almost the same that, and you get to see as she walks home, as soon as she enters, they look at her and they say, is this Naomi? And just like when you are grieving, I've been through a lot of these in life, when you're grieving and somebody who means a lot to you walks in, it's all of a sudden weeping begins. And it's at this time where Naomi opens her heart open and really says what's on her mind and what's on her heart. And once again, that's going to be the question for us. And my prayer is that our church would be a very great environment for people to only say, honestly feel like it's a safe place to bear their hearts open and say, this is what's going on in my life. And then, but not only that, she was in for a ride of God bringing restoration from this moment onwards. But she was so buried in grief, right? She was buried in grief. As she opens up how she's feeling, all of a sudden she lets her situation change her name. And she says, don't call me Pleasant anymore. Call me Mara. All of a sudden, she's looking around. She's looking at her struggles. She's looking at what she's lost. She's looking at everything that she's lost. And you have to be able to. It's so easy sometimes to gloss over that kind of pain as she's going through this. It's easy as people to gloss over that pain because sometimes we look at people as problems to be fixed than just to sit down right there and with them and hear what's going on. But it's kind of beautiful because the people just allow her to talk. She says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Right? Don't call me that because God has brought what? Bitterness. He has dealt bitterly with me. And I like the author, the way the author still just says, okay, that's what Naomi says, but I'm still going to identify her as Naomi. Even after she's wanted to change her own name. So for us today, what is your struggle? If we're looking at this, what is your struggle? Have you begun to identify yourself by your struggle, or are you identifying yourself by what God has called you? And I love Ed Welch in the book, and it's talking about community side by side. He says, our troubles usually begin this internal conversation. This is painful. Why is this happening? And then after that, he says it gets messy. Does God really care? Right? Can his words be trusted? Would a good father protect his children from these things? And he says this is where the beauty of the gospel shines. it shines here, and in fact it shines, and this is actually in this book side by side, he is actually saying that this is the role of Christian community to remind each other of what the gospel has said. And he says, man, like if God was to reply that, and sometimes he uses the community to reply this, he would say, look to Jesus, the crucified and the one who was raised from the dead. The crucified one who suffered, he is the evidence of what? Unfailing love, even in affliction. Why? Because every single one of us, whenever we get to, even those that seem so strong in their faith, whenever we meet suffering, usually our faith goes wobbly. And that is when the community around you needs to celebrate you, remind you once again what Jesus has done. What Jesus said. You know why? Because in suffering, this is the second point, suffering attempts usually to change your view of God above everything. And this is where you have to actually understand. When you're going through hard times, you need to stop for a second and actually remind yourself. Look at yourself in the mirror. It's really not about you. It's not about you. Satan doesn't care about you that much. It's really to change your view of God. It's really not about you. It's about something bigger than that. Right? It's really not about you. And at this moment, you get to see this even at play. Look at verse 20. And she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has what? Brought me back empty. And if you have and it's your own Bible, I want you to kind of start underlining Almighty. And the Lord has dealt very bitterly with me, right? And he said, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Underline the word Lord. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has testified against me. Underline that as well. And the Almighty has brought what? Calamity on me. Underline that. In just two of those sentences, he uses God's name four times. And in fact, there's two things that are going on in this passage that are actually so beautiful, and they don't seem like they can actually coexist with one another. The first thing that you get to see here is that there's blame that's going on here. So in trials, God, because he's so big, because of who he is, he becomes what? The easiest target of blame. Whenever we're going through hard times, it becomes the easiest target of blame. So in trials, it's so easy to target him. And so she had left Bethlehem, and while she was the pleasant one, but as she walks back, into Bethlehem, she says, "I'm no longer pleasant. I'm now bitter." She had left Bethlehem with her quiver full, with children, but now as she walks back in, she doesn't have children and she doesn't have even husbands. And at this moment, she is worse than Job because Job still has his wife. And at this moment, she's worse than Job because Job, at least at this moment, even if she's the female Job, she's actually acting more like Job's wife than Job himself. Like, at least Job could still say, he could still have more kids. But Naomi is saying, it's too late for me. It's too late for me. And at this moment, it might be so easy to just look at it and say, you shouldn't blame God. But when you're sitting at ground zero, it is at this moment where she looks and she says, she uses what authors would say, an ABBA pattern. She would use the word Shaddai and Yahweh, Yahweh and Shaddai. She would say Almighty. And then you'd say the Lord. And then she would say what? Almighty. And there's a big implication on that. Because Shaddai, that word that she's, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. That is the word for the strong one. It's a word that describes a mountain, the unmoved one, the strong one. And it means that he's the God of great power, the cosmic ruler who is in control of everything. Who's in control of everything? He is the one who has done this. The one who is in control of everything. And I love one theologian, J. Moore, says the God who is always at his best, even when man is at his worst. That is the word just to describe this word, Shaddai. And then she's going to use, last week we covered the word Yahweh, the covenant name. She's going to envelope that and say, he is so strong, but he is also my covenant God. And really, at the end of the day, she's actually saying, if you read that, I went away full. The Lord has dragged me back here empty just to embarrass me, really. But not only that, why call me Naomi? The Lord has stood in court. And he has testified against me. And there was no way I could have won this case because he's almighty. He's the strong one. There was no way. And at this moment, Naomi is saying, God is totally against me. Right? Is totally against me. And God, and then this is just the moment when she's feeling this sense of utter abandonment. And she says, God is the one who did this. God is the one who did this. And this is what sometimes we do when life has gone just crazy. We blame God. But the truth of the matter is this: was God still in control? Yes, he was. But was God still at work? Yes, he was. Can you reconcile those things? Sometimes you can't. And I love the fact that, like, just God still just keeps quiet at this moment and lets her go through that. You know, I grew up in a house where my mother, she was a tradeswoman, and so she did a lot of cross stitch and did doils and sweaters. So we never bought a sweater. We would always dress in, like, it looked like Christmas sweaters all year. But she was just good at it. But because we had to all, and because all our meals were dependent on the work that she was doing, we got to know how to do cross stitch as well. So she would take these pieces of cloth and start working on that. And so there were some times when my sister would be working on the stems and my young brother's working on the petals of the roses, and I'm working on something else and somebody else is working, and we would work as a team on this. But the worst thing is that, like, if you turned the thing behind and you looked at it behind, it looked like a mess. That thing looks like a mess from outside. But if you turned it and you started looking, when it was all done and you were presenting it to your customer, it looked beautiful. The work of God's providence is like that. When God is working behind the scenes, it's like that. We're experiencing what looks like it's a mess until we look on the what? On the other side. I like one of my favorite theologians, Puritan, in the 1600s. He says, the providence of God, right? The providence of God is like the Hebrew words. It can only be read what? Backwards. The providence of God, it will never make sense when you're going through the trials. It will never make sense while you're going through it. But when you're now standing on the other side, you start looking backwards. You are at the back of this cross-stitch thing, and you're seeing the mess, and you're feeling the pain of the needle going in and out of you, and God is working something. This is one thing that we know. God never does anything that's substandard of good. Right? At creation, he keeps on. If you really read the Bible very well, you will get to see at creation, when he's making everything, he caps it with a chorus, this is good. This is good. And when he creates man, he says, this is very good. Man's sins, and God brings restoration through Christ, and he begins, Philippians 1:6, he begins a good work, and in a good work in us, and he is faithful. That part, when he is faithful to complete it, is where we are most uncomfortable. But he is doing what? What we say is good work. Right? As we are experiencing the tragedies of sin, the fallen world that is going on around us. And so Elimelech had fallen into that. Death is as a result of sin. All these things are happening in her family, circumstances. There's things going on. But at this point, she looks at God and says, why? But this is where the beauty of it, God starts working things together for his good behind the scenes. And this reminded me of, some of you know one of the greatest preachers that have ever lived, Charles Spurgeon. What you might not know is the story of the woman he was married to, Susanna Spurgeon, and who suffered beyond any means. And so at one point, tens of thousands of people are getting saved. Charles Spurgeon is preaching, and he's probably preaching almost like 4, 5 to 6 times a week. And he is working, and he's working so hard. And in her mid-30s, Susanna Spurgeon has a very complicated birth experience when she's giving birth to her twin boys. And at age 36, at the prime of her husband's career, she's declared an invalid. And she will never leave her bed. She will stay at home for the rest of her life. And she is suffering through all these things. And just because at some point you'd go through prolonged times of just sickness. Sickness upon sickness. And her husband is out there wishing she could be by her side as he's preaching and as he's doing that. And he's also struggling with his own sickness as well. Right? And there's one day when she's, after just going through just a long time of just being sick, she sits down and she starts asking herself, why does God so often send sharp and bitter pains to visit me? Why does my Lord thus deal with his child? Why, God, are you doing this? I thought you called us to ministry. I thought you called us to this. And then she says that her answer came through a parable. As they were sitting next to a fire, there was a log that was in the fire that began. Have you ever heard when logs start making noise? When they start making noise. And she said, and she describes this, and it says the answer, unexpected yet plain, came in the form of a parable. Into the silence of the room, disturbed by the noise of the crackling log burning in the heat, the room disturbed by this noise was broken into by a sound, clear and musical, not unlike birdsong. Listen to me. Not unlike birdsong. We listened again and heard the faint, plaintive notes, sweet and so melodious, yet mysterious enough to provoke a moment of our undisguised wonder. Suddenly, Susanna's friend exclaimed, "It comes from the log over there." And she was right. The fire was letting loose imprisoned music. Right. And she says this, "Ah," thought I, "when the fire of affliction draws songs of praise from us, then indeed we are purified, and our God is glorified." And she says this, singing in the fire, yes, God helping us. If that is the only way for only God to get harmony out of these apathetic, divided hearts, let the furnace be heated 7 times harder than before. It's so hard to see that. She's saying that, if this is the way God is going to get praise from my life, let the fire be heated 7 times. And I wish you just could hear that. And for you, you would say, wow, that sounded so positive in the midst of the struggle. Because a week or 2 weeks after that, Charles Spurgeon is going to walk in with a book, lectures to my students, and as he's mentoring his students, and he says one statement that changes Susanna Spurgeon's life forever, even up to today. And he walks and he says, I wish I could get this book in the hands of every minister in England. At that time, pastors were getting £60 a year. It was a luxury to get books, right? I feel bad even reading that because of my library, right? And it was a luxury to get just books. And so Susanna, and on her bed, she says she heard God clearly saying, you can do it. And then she sent her servant downstairs to get all her earrings, every single thing. She says, I sold all these things just to get the first books out. And she sends them out. By the time she was dead, by the time she died, she had sent more than 100,000 books to pastors all around the country. As Charles Spurgeon is preaching to the masses, Susanna Spurgeon is preaching to the laborers who are multiplying people upon people. On her bed, she influenced England more than anybody would ever know. And they say that missionaries from all across the world started writing to her, and she would send them to anybody and everybody. God's glory in her bed. In her bed. And not only that, we go to a conference, me and Larry, every single year. And we usually walk out of there with books on boxes, and usually those ones are coming from Miss Spurgeon's fund. People have not stopped donating to that fund to actually give books to pastors all over the world. 100 years after she's died, she's still working. That God working behind the scenes. Oh, I'm here to say, don't look down on your pain. I'm here to say that whatever you're going through, don't look. And so this is actually now where we get to see, if you look at God from the view of providence and know that God is working behind that, you will have some of the best worship experiences ever in life. This is Paul. He would say, I want to know Christ. I want to know Christ. I want to know him so much and fellowship with him even in suffering. There is a way by which Christians evade, just like by avoiding sufferings, you avoid a fellowship with Christ that you've never known. And so we get to see, and then there's just something else that you get to see in Naomi here. You get to see her faith. I love the fact that, like, Naomi is going towards Bethlehem, but she's also still blaming God. Do you know that is one of the greatest statements of faith you will ever see in the Bible? Whenever we hit hard times and we blame God, usually we won't see you in church for a couple of weeks. We won't see you for a month. And some of the people that I've talked to have stopped coming to church for years. But I love this because for Naomi, even though she's blaming God, you know where she's going toward? She's going towards God. Towards the house of bread. She's going towards God. And she goes and she sits in Bethlehem, right underneath the shadow of his wings. And she gives God enough time to actually bring things all the way around. And God to begin working in her life, right? And this is what I love about the Bible. The Bible is so clear with us. And I love, because he is God El Shaddai, he's a God who is so strong. He doesn't defend himself when Naomi is actually saying these things about God. He continues working behind the scenes. He is God who can take, this is now the theology that a lot of us might need to adopt. Sometimes our prayers need to come in form of complaints before God. When the real you meets the real God, and you can be able to say, if it sucks, it sucks. And we see that. We see that all over the Bible. Moses is going to talk to God like that. Not out of disrespect, just hear me out. Elijah's going to talk to God like that. Not out of disrespect, but really just like opening their hearts. David is going to talk to God like that. I feel like you've abandoned me. And God is going to say, that's the man after my heart. But not only that, Jesus is going to do that at the cross. He's going to say, my Lord, why have you forsaken me? But also he's going to turn around and say, but into your hands I commit what? My spirit. It's possible that you can be so honest with God about how you feel to God in your community and not betray your faith in God. It is possible. It is possible. So we get to see this. Right? This leads us. This is just like you kind of get to see God doesn't disown her for feeling this way. He just keeps working, even at this. And in this, and at the height of her blame to God, he doesn't defend himself, but his work begins to shine even from behind the scenes. I want you to follow me. This is my third point here. You get to see confidence in providence, in the providence of God, in the providence of God will help us from getting assigned other identities and blaming God, but to turn to him even in times of trials. So I want you to kind of just get to see God at work. Naomi is so buried underneath her grief, she doesn't even see that God is actually at work. So if you can just look at verse 22 for a second, and Naomi and Ruth, the Moabite, returned to with her daughter-in-law, with her, returned to the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And for you, you might just look at that and you think, okay, that was actually almost like the first sign of hope that God was working. It was not coincidence that she gets to walk back in. She walked away from Bethlehem when the house of bread was empty. She goes away and she goes away to greener pastures. That's where she experiences what? True emptiness. But God brings her back. And you can even hear that in her voice. God brought me back empty. He brought me back empty. But what was he bringing me back to? To fullness. He brought me back empty, but he was bringing me back to what? To fullness. And we can get to see, and as you're reading this, I hope you're seeing the house of bread finally beginning to fill up with bread. Bethlehem is starting to have a supply of bread. This is God saying literally to Naomi, you don't have a husband, but I am your husband, and I'm going to take care of you. This is God saying, I will never leave you nor forsake you, Naomi. You, even though you feel like I've abandoned, your husband has died just the same. This is the same picture that you get to see when King Uzziah dies in Isaiah 6. The King Uzziah dies. The Lord is still seated on the throne. Is God still king in your life even during that time? Yes, he is. Is he your provider? Yes, he is. Is he active? Yes, he is, even in that time. You get to see that. And Naomi's bitterness was so blinded from that. God begins working even in there, right? And she returns, and another thing that you get to see, look at 2 verse 1, she returns to a people where God is still king. Returns to a people where God is still king. Now, Naomi had a relative, and I love this because you get to see this. We're going to deal with this with more next week. A relative of her husband. She knows this man, but doesn't expect help from him. Maybe she's even forgotten. This is somebody in her household. A worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name is Boaz. I love that phrase, a worthy man. And that word, a worthy man, this is the same word, mighty man of valor, that is actually in Judges. God approaches Gideon and says, he's going to say, you are a mighty man of valor. Gideon is going to be military-wise, but here he's coming to this man, which is what we're going to deal with next week, and he calls him a mighty man of valor. Why? Because number one, he's influential, he's got wealth and all that, but there's something else that's making him a mighty man of valor. It's because God is still king in his life. It's because God is still king in his life. How are you going to know that? Because he is going to begin, even when he comes, and we're going to look at that. He comes as a wealthy man, the way he greets his workers, the way they respect him, the way he keeps on saying, even he looks at Ruth and he's going to talk to her and say that, may God hide you under the shadow of his wings, right? And he's saying, and he keeps on blessing. Everywhere he goes, he's a blessing, even if he doesn't have to be. And I want you to kind of get to see. And so this man is a man that is fit to become what? To become a redeemer for Naomi. She comes back, and God is working behind the scenes, where everybody lives as they see fit, but there's this man who at least can still keep this law of the redeemer. A relative of a husband who would actually adopt, who would marry his brother's wife, or who would adopt his brother's wife and provide over her, because women in those days, it was a patriarchal society, where if you didn't have a husband taking care of you, everything was lost. But she begins, and then things just start moving. From this moment, hope still just begins. And you get to see this through Boaz's character. God's plan is so evident because he appoints Boaz, and you get to see that this is God working his providence. A man who has wealth, but not only that, who has his fields. And what's going on is that God had actually written a law of gleaning. Look at Leviticus 19, verse 9 to 10. This is God literally taking care. He had written this law, and this law, she comes in at the beginning of the barley harvest. There is a man who has a field, and listen, at this time, foreigners are treated really bad. But look at this. Leviticus 9, verse 19, verse 9. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, right? Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather fallen grapes from your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. I want you to just underline that. I am the Lord your God. He's saying, I am going to take care of the widows and the orphans. Look at Leviticus 23:22. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. And you shall not gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave for the poor and the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. You know why probably he kept it with I am the Lord your God? He's also saying, I am still a covenant keeping God who's going to watch over even those that have nothing. And guess what? Naomi walks right into that kind of environment. You get to see Ruth saying in verse 2, and Ruth the Moabite, the foreigner, saying, let me go to the field and glean amongst the ears of grain after him in whose sight I find favor. There's a reason why that phrase is in there. Because as a Moabite, she would have actually found. You're going to see Boaz actually later on saying, glean here, you're protected here in this field. Because like foreign women, some of the men would just abuse them. They would rape them. They would do all that. She goes and she walks right. Look at this with me. Right? And so she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened, if you want to just underline, that's probably the best phrase in the whole Bible. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to what? God-fearing, God-honoring, very resourced man. Potentially redeemer, Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And if you're reading this, this is where literally, if you are reading this story to people, this is when they would drop their jaw. Because all of a sudden, at this moment, it's just like, if you are translating it dynamically, like in fact, like the way the Hebrew reads it, it says, her chance chanced the portion of the field of Boaz. It just says she chanced it. She just happened to be like, and this is like, for her, she's going many, many, many more, whatever is going on. But God's saying, hey, listen, and he's driving us straight into it. And it is just like it's a way for the narrator to show you who's really in control of this thing that's going on. Who's really in control? And you want to see, this is a way for him to say, do you see God's hand here at work? The same hand that sent the famine in the land later provided food in chapter 1, verse 6. And the same hand that brought Naomi and Ruth back to Bethlehem at the beginning of the harvest is the same hand that's leading her to the portion of the what? Of where there is bread. And I want you just going to see through this, though the needle has been going in and out of this cross stitch, all of a sudden the beauty of this is starting to show. You are starting to get to see God being faithful even now. God has looked around, just like he says in 2 Chronicles 16:9, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give support to those whose heart is blameless before God. He looks around and he starts using his kindness, that he starts using it to actually bring what? Relief to Naomi. To bring restoration. And this is where I just want you to get to see there's a God at work. And that God's chesed is at work. His loyalty to his people is at work. But also we get to see human loyalty here. Human loyalty, which is actually what the church is called to do. Human loyalty is seen through a man who's loyal to God, being chosen to actually take care of the widow, is seen through Ruth, who's actually, her name means friend, and she comes and befriends her. And throughout this whole thing, you see Naomi's heart starting to actually, what? Thaw from being a big block of ice. She says, you go, my daughter. It sounds so kind. Let me ask these guys to come up. It sounds so kind. But I want you to kind of get to see, you get to see God's loyalty in this text. Don't miss this. You get to see God's loyalty, but you get to see God's human loyalty through God working behind the scenes, and then you get to see God working what? Working through people. God's loyalty and human loyalty working together to bring about the best story ever told, the redemption of all mankind.
Thank you for listening to this message from City Church, located in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. For additional information, please visit citychurchpa.org.